Welcome to the EFFP podcast, the R&R files as we're calling them, Radcliffe and Rawson, and what will hopefully be the first of many interviews with industry leaders, covering a range of subjects from soil health to marketing to sustainable procurement. And there's no better place to start this series of podcasts than with Robin Sundaram, who's the Responsible Sourcing Manager at Nestlé. We've been very fortunate over the years to work closely with Robin and Nestlé, supporting the development and implementation of their dairy procurement and sustainability plan, and work that we are particularly proud of. And interestingly, it was actually through this work and spending endless hours travelling on trains up to Nestlé's factories in the Northwest that I managed to persuade Robin that my hometown of Lewes was a great place to live. And I think 5 or 6 years ago, Robin, you moved to Lewes, which means that we can now walk to the pub for beers on a regular basis, doing our bit for climate change. So, Robin, how many years was it? And then could you just introduce yourself by saying who you are and what you actually do at Nestlé?
Thanks, Duncan. Yeah, it was 2016. We moved down to Lewes, and I have to admit that was the best decision probably we ever made. So thank you for that.
Probably the only bit of advice I gave you that I didn't charge you for.
Yeah, good point. I'm the Responsible Sourcing Manager for Nestlé UK and Ireland, and that basically means that I've got a number of hats, I guess. Partly is to make sure that we are delivering against our global responsible sourcing approach, which is all about making sure that we can trace all of our supply chain back to farmers and plantations where we can, but also then implementing against the Nestlé responsible sourcing standard, as we call it. So that you can imagine we're the biggest food and beverage company in the world. We buy 1% of the world's agricultural output. So we've got a huge, huge footprint, huge responsibility. So I've sort of lead that element for the UK, but also it's broader than just the environmental. So how can we, through working with our suppliers, really have more of a positive social impact as well? And then thirdly is working with our farmers. And it has really started with our fresh milk supply from First Milk, and that milk goes into brands such as Kit Kat, Quality Street, Aero, and our Nescafe cappuccinos. And that's how you and I first obviously started working together. Yeah. And I can't remember when that was, actually.
It was quite a lot of years ago. Yeah, but I try not to think about things like that. I'm really intrigued to actually understand a little bit more detail what sustainability actually means to you and to Nestlé, and why taking action on it is important.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it goes back to sort of the fundamental principles of what sustainability is all about. So it's the three elements of environmental, social, and economic. So it's really, as I said, we are a big company. We do have a big impact globally. Yeah. And it's just really facing into, I think for the first time across many companies, is really starting to not only understand the impact that we have and the reliance that we have on our natural resources and the people in our supply chain, but what can we actually start to do against that? And I think it's moving the dial. I think a lot of companies, and we probably fit within this, is when we've talked about CSR, corporate social responsibility, for a long time, but for a lot of companies that's basically meant how can we make sure we do no harm. So it was very kind of compliance based, I think. Yeah. And we've got to move the dial to actually moving from how can we do no harm to how can we do good? And it's quite subtle, but it's really important. And some companies have done it better than others. Some brands have done it really, really well. But we as an organization, and we've called it creating shared value for many, many years. Mm-hmm. We've been around for 154 years. So I don't believe a company can be around that long without doing something right when in terms of the social and environmental impact. But there's a lot more we can be doing, and as we as a business have really ramped up the focus on that, and it really starts with our farmers, because our agricultural supply chain is huge. Our footprint, I mean, in terms of directly sourcing from farmers around the world, we're talking about 200,000 to 250,000, but indirectly we think it might be as many as 4 million. So it really starts there for us.
Yeah, I want to come back to the UK in a second, if I may. But at sort of that global level, you're saying you're buying 1% of all production across the globe. What sort of activities are you doing at that global level to make that difference to the social and environmental challenges facing Nestlé, but facing the world, of course?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a big question. So there's a number of things. So firstly, it is really understanding our carbon, our greenhouse gas impact. And therefore, we have done a big exercise looking at our global footprint, which is apparently something like 116 million tonnes, which, to put it in perspective, that's, if you look at where our head office is in Switzerland, I mean, Switzerland is an advanced nation with a big footprint, and the global Nestlé footprint is twice that of Switzerland. Right. So it's really understanding what are the key things that we can do to reduce that footprint. But and when we've done that work, we've identified that 95% of that is outside of our direct control. So all we can really directly control is our factories and our offices. So the rest, and 55 to 60% of that is in our agricultural supply chain. So the number one focus is working on that, and really the single biggest thing we can do is regenerative agriculture. Mm-hmm. So that's the first. But clearly it's broader than that when it comes to the environmental. So you think about packaging and plastics. I think if there's been a load of data statistics to show that, I think if you look on the plastics that you see on beaches and that kind of thing, behind some big brands like Pepsi and Coca-Cola is Nestlé. A lot of Nestlé brands. So there's the whole move towards recyclable, reusable packaging, and we've made commitments that by 2025 we are going to achieve 100% for recyclable and reusable. So there's probably the big two, but then there are things like looking at our overall portfolio and how can we move our portfolio into more products that are, I guess, have less of a global footprint in terms of greenhouse gases. And then there's our logistics. And I think, again, I've heard this and I'm not quite sure where the statistic comes from, but if we were a global shipping company, we would be the third biggest shipping company in the world. That's just how much we're shipping products around the world. So logistics is a big focus as well. Yeah. So those are all the big kind of environmental, but on the social side, just as important, we know that modern slavery is not only in existence, but is actually growing around the world. So how can we really start to get to grips with that? And we know that there are children working in our supply chain in the Ivory Coast and places like that. And mm-hmm. we've been actively working with third parties like the Fair Labor Association and with our suppliers to not only understand why it's happening, but what can we do to try and fix that. And we've done things like building schools. We've built 50 schools in the Ivory Coast. But mm-hmm. this is something that is, is within those populations, has been around for a long time. It's not something we can fix quickly, yeah. But we really have to focus into it. And then, of course, the economic side is how do we make sure that we are paying the right amounts that we need to make sure that people can actually make a living throughout our supply chain. Yeah. They're the big focus areas, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, that's on a global scale. Obviously, the UK marketplace is somewhat different to other parts of the world, of course. But I'm just interested, what is the role of supply chains in tackling some of these issues? And can you explain how you've actually approached this in the UK across dairy, which obviously I was involved with, but also, I believe, more recently with wheat as well? And in particular, how have you actually engaged with the farmers who supply your raw materials?
Yeah, so for the UK, again, if you look at the kind of raw materials that we buy, actually, if you think on it at a global scale, again, we're known as a coffee company. We've got, Nescafe, Nespresso, and actually more, a lot of Starbucks products. Basically any Starbucks product you buy outside of Starbucks itself is a Nestlé product now. So we've got a big coffee footprint. We've clearly got a big cocoa footprint. And in terms of we buy 10% of the world's cocoa as we do 10% of the world's coffee. But when it comes to the UK, and, of course, we can't, we don't produce coffee, cocoa, palm oil, those kinds of things in the UK. So the single biggest ingredient in the UK is fresh milk. The second is wheat, and the third is sugar. So we're tackling each in turn, and we started with fresh milk, and that's really how we started working with the FFP back in the day, as we said. And the approach we took really is we're working with First Milk. We've got a number of farmers. At the time, it was just over 100. We're about 80 farmers now, and that's just simply because as farmers have come out of farming, we've expanded the amount of milk that each of our individual farmers can provide to Nestle. But we've got a factory in Girvan in Scotland, which produces all our chocolate crumb, which then goes into products like Kit Kat. And we've got a factory in Cumbria in Dalston, which produces all our Nescafe cappuccinos and things. And we, in the past, what we were doing is we didn't really think about, well, okay, what can we do working with our farmers to drive our environmental and social credentials around those. So really we sat down, and this is where EFFP really helped to bring us together. As we sat down to work out, well, what are the things, how do we want to work with First Milk was the first question. And we came up, basically, we effectively said, we've got to make this a much more strategic long-term partnership. Yeah. So that was the first thing we identified. We sat down with First Milk and you guys helped kind of broker those discussions. And then the second thing we said was, okay, well, what does an environmental plan look like? And that was where we, again, you guys introduced us to the Allerton Project and Alistair Lee.
Conservation Trust, yeah.
And Jim Egan. And we sat down. I remember that first conversation at the British Library. Mm-hmm. And from that, we basically created a plan, working again with First Milk, that I think at the time was pretty groundbreaking, and I still think it's pretty groundbreaking, which was a pricing mechanism that was that worked for the farmers, that looked at how can we improve productivity, how can we reduce our footprint, and how can we take out volatility in milk price, which the farmers were seeing and ourselves. And so from the back of that, we created this mechanism that had a base price, which paid a premium based on the other milk producers in the regions where we operate. But then we also said we're going to pay a sustainability bonus. And that sustainability bonus was based on a menu of options that farmers could deliver both environmentally and socially. And this is where the Allerton Project and Wildlife Conservation Trust were able to really help identify what does that look like? What are the different interventions that farmers could implement, and what are the outcomes that we would get from doing those? So that's what we started to do, and then I think we identified very early, to answer your question in terms of how do we engage farmers, we realised early on that this, at first, you've got to make it relatively straightforward. Yeah. It was, so we went out with a survey to farmers to really understand how many of them were involved in current stewardship schemes, by doing that survey, we found out that only 11% of our farmers were actually engaged in those schemes. And when we asked why, one of the reasons was it's just overly bureaucratic, really hard to. They weren't able to see the benefit from the investment in terms of time and effort to do it. So off the back of that, we created this. The process that tried to make it as simple as possible. So firstly, we came up with things that farmers, it was relatively straightforward for farmers to implement, things like fixing of hedgerows, planting trees, fencing of waterways, and school visits. But secondly, we said, well, in terms of making, providing evidence, let's just make it simple in the sense that they could take a photo before they do the work, take a photo of them doing the work, and then take a photo of the finished work. And then we would kind of go on trust, just looking at the photos, that the work was done. Yeah. So there weren't these huge forms that they had to fill in or anything like that. So, and by implementing that, by getting Jim and the guys from Allerton Project helping to set up farmer discussions, where again we didn't do it in classrooms, we went out on farms themselves and really got the farmers to start to engage through doing that. That's how we, so this combination of making it a pricing mechanism that actually a sustainability bonus that actually farmers were, it was worth their while. So, you know, it was commercially made sense to farmers, combined with an ease of implementation and recording, combined with having people on the ground that could, who understood farmers. I think all of that together has really made it a bit easier for farmers to engage. Yeah.
I remember also, and I think this is something that we are passionate about at EFFP, is that we involved farmers in the design and the development of it right from the very beginning. And I remember sitting in First Melt's offices, actually, sort of presenting our framework. And, yeah, we were a little bit nervous about how far we could push this, and then discovered that the farmers were looking to push it further than we were looking to push it, which was really interesting. But I think that that's such a crucial part of the development of any sort of initiative like this, is getting farmers involved, because they understand their businesses far better than we do. And then they will buy into the process as well if you involve them.
Yeah, and I think exactly that. And the big eye-opener for me, Duncan, I don't know if you remember, is when we did the work with CISL, where they were working with a number of organisations, ourselves and a lot of other kind of milk producers, and created a really good report, actually, in terms of looking at soil biodiversity, water, what are the kinds of things that could be implemented. And they researched all this work that was done around the world, and a really good report, really good ideas that came out of it. And then we had this session at the House of Lords where they launched it, and I took three of our First Milk farmers, Nestle farmers, down to this session at the House of Lords. Over 100 people there, and our three farmers were the only farmers in the room. And that was the light bulb moment for me, when I realized all these big conversations are happening without farmers in the room.
Yeah.
And that was the moment it was off the back of that. We sat down with the Game Wildlife Conservation Trust. It was literally off the back of that.
I do remember that. And it's, you know, we know that agriculture and farming is causing a lot of environmental issues. You know, we know that, but we also know that farming has got, you know, a lot of the answers to the environmental issues as well. You know, we have to be engaging farmers in that conversation. You know, how can we make any progress if we don't?
Yeah.
I'm intrigued to know, because you know, it's very good to talk about the sort of successful things and the things we've got right. And yeah, I would agree with one of your earlier points, actually, in terms of all the work that EFFP have been involved with, and pricing mechanisms, all those sorts of things. I still believe this one is one of the most innovative that we've been involved with, and has really sort of stood the test of time. But what lessons have you learnt along the way? I mean, what might you do differently if you could start this process again?
If I'm honest, not a huge amount differently. I think we actually got quite a lot right in the first place, in the sense that we, as you said, we engaged farmers in the design, and we got experts in to help deliver it on the ground, to help that behaviour change. I think, On reflection, working directly with farmers and First Milk, is maybe we would have spent a bit more time just maybe running by the ideas at the beginning, maybe with more farmers. I think we had four involved in the design of it. Yeah. I think secondly, as well, as we started to implement it, we probably should have taken more time to get feedback through the process as the implementation happened. There's also, from a systems recording perspective as well, we did set up a good relatively simple, straightforward system, but it would have been ideal for it to, at the same time, maybe try and get it to link in directly into Nestle and our system, so that we were able to have real-time reporting and all the rest around that. I think internally, within Nestle, again, we got it right in terms of getting the agreement to make it happen, to trial it. But it was, if I'm honest, it was more a leap of faith than based on any real life kind of data. If you remember, you know, milk price crashed, and we maintained the price for a long time, and it wasn't based on any kind of science. It was based on, okay, we've got to protect our farmers. Let's just, this price feels right. And I was able to persuade my business that it was the right thing to do, even though I was under quite a lot of pressure around what's the science behind this, around that. But yeah, I think in terms of if I were to do it again, I would get more of our business involved in the process up front, and particularly our marketing colleagues, because we have never to this day really made any kind of, we haven't done really any communications around our brands, around all the good work that our milk plan has delivered working with our farmers. And
you can't see me at the moment, but I'm smiling broadly, because that is an issue that we come across regularly with a number of our clients, is that there's such great work that's been done, driven by the sort of the sustainability functions within a business, often actually resourced by marketing side of the business. But marketing aren't grabbing hold of it and turning what I think are some great stories out there into sort of marketing collateral, and sort of showcasing what they're doing. So I'm smiling because you're not alone in terms of that challenge.
There are so many good messages. There's the whole kind of, it's UK, so the whole provenance angle. Particularly our farmers, our Nestlé farmers, they're small family farms really, and it's the stories you could tell around families and the impact. We've got positive impact in terms of generations of farmers, and actually a number of our farmers are wanting to be able to tell that story. And this is I don't know whether we're going to get into it in this discussion, Duncan, but the whole next generation program that we implemented, which again you guys helped to design and deliver, that was brilliant in terms of really understanding our younger farmers, but getting them to really understand how they could really make a difference themselves, not only as ambassadors for Nestlé, but also understanding how they could improve their own farm performance.
I think that's a whole separate podcast, which has just put an idea into my head. I find it fascinating, and I feel very proud actually when you see some of the guys that are part of that Next Generation program and how they're continuing to develop their own careers at the moment, which is something we're very proud to be involved with. I mean, the key question is, I mean, you've made such great progress, but as we all know, with this subject around social and environmental sustainability, it comes never ending. So what next? How do you plan to build on what you've already achieved?
So it's two levels. So firstly, when it comes to the first milk dairy farmers, is that we said in the early days the interventions, the activations that farmers could do on farm, we tried to make it relatively straightforward by doing things like hedgerows and that kind of thing. We now, if we're really going to be serious about regenerative agriculture, we have to raise the ante and we have to think longer term things that our farmers can do. And a massive focus has got to be soil health and the organic matter in the farm. So the new version of the milk plan that we're delivering, which is going to be implemented over the next 5 years, is really focused on pasture land and the grass, and trying to really drive that soil organic matter so that we start to sequester a lot more of the carbon. And the whole focus on carbon, because we did start to use the Cool Farm tool, we moved away from that, but we're actually going to, globally Nestlé is using the Cool Farm tool, so we're back to that, but we want to really understand that side of it. And then there's things around, for instance, mob grazing, and what can we do more around that? What can we do around feed? And the last thing we want to really move away from, all the deforestation that's caused by feed, and really start to bring it local and feed from forage, that kind of thing. So there's the raising the ante in terms of our greenhouse gas footprint, but also at the same time, animal welfare is still, not only is it a massive issue and a concern, but it's something that we really need to drive even harder. So what are the things that we need to continue to do around animal welfare? And then the third is the social side. Again, I mean, COVID has meant that we haven't been able to get children into schools, and our farmers have been quite innovative in filming what they do on farm, and then they've been showing that in the schools. But I really want to, now more than ever, when we come out of COVID, hopefully in lockdown, is how do we start to really engage with schools and get children to understand where their food comes from, the impact in the environment, countryside, all of that, So there's that side of on the milk plan. But as you touched on earlier, there's the wheat plan is the next one. So we're actively working with our wheat suppliers to implement implement a program. And what is really exciting about this is we're working with this concept called Lens, working with 3Kill and some other people. But the Lens is all about, this is about shared investment in outcomes on farms. So you start to look at big areas like catchments, and you're saying
river catchments.
In a region, and you say, so for example in Cumbria, yes, we're already doing, our farmers are doing a huge amount of work that has got a certain number of outcomes, but actually the water companies are looking for a reduction in phosphates and nitrates and all the rest and then you've got the house building companies who now by law have to implement biodiversity targets. You've got the insurance companies that every year when there's more and more flooding, they're paying out costs. Yeah. So you've got all of these different industries who are all interested in farmers implementing certain activities that have different types of outcomes. So if you can share your investment and effectively incentivize the farmers, and that's what we're going to do with wheat in the UK around East Anglia, Northamptonshire. As you say, you're paying the farmers for the goods they provide, which is the wheat, but you're paying the farmers for the ecosystems that they provide as well. So that's the approach that we're going to be taking. We're working, I know DEFRA are involved because there's Lens happening as well. So what we need to make sure is that there's no confusion amongst farmers about, well, what does Lens mean compared to what does Elms mean? Does it make sense for me to wait for Elms to come into place, or should I start to work on Lens? How are we going to measure? So there is a big piece of work to be done to make sure that the farmers understand what all these are about. But the single biggest thing we have to work on, it goes back to what we did with the milk farmers, is this is about behavior change. You and I have talked about this in the past. Ben, you can throw as much money as you like at farmers to make it happen, but ultimately it's about behavior change. And we are investing in Nestle. You might have seen some of the numbers, but over the next 5 years, we'll be investing $3 billion globally, not just UK, globally into our carbon commitments, and the vast majority of that will be into regenerative agriculture, which is great. But funding alone isn't going to be enough. How are we going to get the farmers to change? And the way I'm kind of describing it internally to try and get people to understand is sort of saying to some farmers, it's such a big change. It's like saying to us and our colleagues in the offices, we're going to ask you to move from laptops back to using typewriters. We're going to ask you to move from mobile phones back to using landlines. Some farmers, it's the scale of change, is that kind of change that we're asking. And so let's not expect it to be really straightforward, but we need to do it.
I've said for a little while, I think we're at a sort of a tipping point in the industry where there is a need to move back to regenerative agriculture. But we've also, the technological tipping point at the moment with such great innovations coming at us, much greater understanding now starting to develop around soils, etc., and how we can use technology to improve the way that we farm. That for me, it's a really exciting time. We're running out of time now, Robin, and we've sort of got a minute left, off this half an hour. And I know you're an optimistic guy, but how do you feel about the future of agriculture and food when you look ahead?
I am very optimistic because, as you said, I think there's a lot of technological advancements that are happening. You've also got companies, not only ourselves, lots of other companies who are making commitments around all of this. You've got the NFU, you've got commitments, the government. So everyone is saying the right thing. And I do think we have to make change. So I think all of the right, we've got all the right things are being said. We've got to turn it into action, and the right actions are starting to happen. And I think you'll start to get this groundswell. In fact, groundswell as an organisation are doing a great thing as well. But I was talking to a farmer recently, and he said something to me that really, for me, summed it up. Is he said the average age of a farmer in the UK is 59. We know that. And he said there was a farmer that he was talking to who said, I've never made, I'm not really interested in all of this until my granddaughter, who is 11, said, Granddad, why have I not seen any birds on your farm? And that was the light bulb moment for him. And he's now going to implement regenerative agriculture because of what his granddaughter said. And I think that, that pull that's going to come from the grandchildren, as much as anything else, is going to help make the difference. Yeah.
That, Robin, is a fantastic way to finish this first podcast on such a positive note. So thank you very much for your time today. I owe you a beer. We'll arrange that soon. I've got no excuse, as you only live around the corner. So we'll make that happen. But thank you very much, Robin.
No problem. Thank you.